From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. From the very start, Amalie Mongren has been in places where she's had to fit herself into her surroundings, which might be why she says that home is wherever my two feet are. She's gone from a child of Quebecois parents growing up in rural northeastern Ontario, to a high school exchange student in Turkey, to big city life in Montreal to university, and then to Shanghai right after graduation. Then a real adventure began. From the typical party scene as one of the very few female expats in 1990 Shanghai, to building a business in the textile sector during China's manufacturing boom, to raising his son and then sending him off to university in a home country that he'd never lived in, she's done it all. Now she's on a whole new adventure, empty nesting. It's a story of nonstop exploration and personal evolution, where even her chosen career has become a glorified excuse to travel the world and a vehicle for offering mentoring to young professionals in her field, something that she never had in her early Shanghai days. I had a great time getting to know Amalie. Her story repeats the theme that has been coming up again and again during my interviews, namely that people who've lived overseas for a long time are changed profoundly by their experiences in some ways, but their origin identity, that which came first and is more indicative of where they came from, holds true and becomes ever more important. As regular listeners will know, it's something that I've been discovering by myself. If you're interested to learn a little bit more about the unique culture of French Canadians in Ontario, there's a great story that came out in the New York Times about these people and some of the stuff that's going on with their language and identity that's kind of under threat right now. It came out in the New York Times, ironically, about a week after I recorded my interview with Amalie. There's a link to it in the show notes. I highly encourage you to check it out. But for right now, just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Amalie Mongren. Amalie Mongren, welcome to Migratory Patterns. Where is home?
Thanks. Where is home? Home is where my two feet are.
Whoa. So it could be anywhere.
Yeah.
Are there any preconditions on the feet? If the feet are in Antarctica, do you consider Antarctica home?
Well, you know, kind of, yeah.
Okay.
It's where I am. So to me, I like to make home wherever I am. And that's basically what would be my purpose. I'm not saying it's exactly that, but
okay.
To me, that's where I would like to be.
It's probably the most expansive kind of definition I've heard. Some people have said the world, but someone to bring the whole world down to where they are and themselves, that's pretty awesome, actually. I like that. Where did you start? Where did you come from? Where did you spring forth from?
All right. Well, I'm from Canada, from up north in Ontario, and I'm French-Canadian.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Vote Bloc. But you're in Ontario. There's
exactly.
There's no Bloc candidates in Ontario.
So that's the thing. It's always a bit more complicated with me.
Yeah.
And basically, we are proud saying we're Franco-Ontarian, and we're fighting for our language.
Oh, wow.
That's
going to be a whole crazy thing, because I'm vaguely familiar with the Bloc, and I often like to say to my friends and, well, to anyone who likes to talk politics, I think any democracy, healthy democracy, needs a good separatist party. Like, it just keeps everyone else honest.
Well, yeah, exactly. And what I love to be, it's to be able to jump from one side to the other.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's fun.
So what's the name of the town in Ontario you're from?
New Liskeard.
New Liskeard?
Yeah. And it was part of a tri-town. So we had Cobalt, Halbury, and New Liskeard. So
those are the most Canadian-sounding towns I've ever heard.
Yeah, and it was a tri-town.
How big are these towns?
5,000 people in each town.
Wow.
So it was a big 15,000.
How far away were you from a major city?
Well, I always say to people I'm in between North Bay and Timmins, so it's an hour and a half one way and 2 hours the other way. Mm. And usually if people say, I've been to in Ontario up north, so they say, oh, okay, so you're there. And it's basically on the Timiskaming Lake. And the reason that we grew up there, my parents are from Quebec, and they wanted us to learn English. So when they got married, they moved to the first town on the side of the borders between Quebec and Ontario.
We need to go in, but we're only going in as absolutely as minimally as far as we have
exactly.
to.
Exactly. Exactly that. Yeah. Yeah.
So what was your journey? How did you get from there to where we are now, which is Shanghai?
Well, my journey starts, I think I have to talk about when I was 16 years old, I was bored out of my mind in this hometown. And we had a poster on the wall of our high school saying, be adventurous, be an exchange student. So, you know, it was at the time that you still have to mail things out and you didn't write emails. So basically I took it down and I had 10 slots to fill in. Where would I want to go? And it's anywhere in the world. So I wanted to go to Europe. And strangely, I wanted to go to Germany, but I had 10 choices. I started with Germany. Then I said UK. And then I put pretty much everything down until I got to number 10. I was just like, wow, I'm running out of country. And finally, what I did is look at the atlas and I saw that Turkey had a little piece in Europe. So I put Turkey. So then I got my letter back saying, congrats, you're going to Turkey. And finally, that's how I started. So I went there and that's where I went from meat and potatoes in Canada to Turkey, what was totally, totally different from
tabbouleh.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it was so insane that the first month I didn't eat, right? But then I knew that I wanted to travel. That was the real thing. So when I came back from Turkey, because that's another podcast altogether, I was sure that I wanted to travel. And then so I wanted to go into political sciences to be able to work in embassies. But that didn't work out because I'm not really a scholar person that sat, you know, and learning politics and all of that. So I went to fashion school.
Oh.
Yeah, because my parents were merchant. My mother's a seamstress. I said, okay, let's go to fashion school.
That's what you know.
Yeah, that's what I know.
Where was school?
Montreal.
Oh, Montreal.
Yeah.
I love Montreal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a lovely place.
I grew up in Boston and I used to drive up to Montreal all the time. Love. It's a 6-hour drive, but it's like, it's long enough where it's long, but it's not so long that you can't do it.
Yeah.
It's a very nice drive. Always stop in Montpelier for food.
Oh, nice.
So many
great
memories. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're did your exchange in Turkey, then you're back in Montreal. And what was the process after that? Did you immediately go back overseas when you finished school?
Well, yeah. So basically, I wanted to stay in Montreal for the summer because my parents wanted me to take over the business. And in my mind, there was no way I was going back to New Liskeard. So I said to my parents, give me the summer, let me work in Montreal, and then I'll come back. And I remember my mother saying, you better get a job. I'm giving you a week to find a job. Otherwise, you're coming right back. So the next day, I call home and I said, Mom, found a job. And she goes, thank God. I said, well, got to travel a bit. And she goes, okay, so where are you going? And I got an offer to come to China.
China?
Yeah.
So when was this?
In June 1996.
Wow. So this was like 7 years after the nothing that happened.
Yeah.
Wow. Very different, very different country back then.
Definitely.
And you've been here ever since?
Yes.
My goodness.
Yes.
Have you been in Shanghai the whole time?
The whole time. Travel China, but always coming back to Shanghai.
Did you buy any real estate?
No, see, that's a question of no. Because at that time, I had no money.
Yeah, there's that very famous picture that shows Shanghai, Pudong, you know, the other side of the Bund, for people who aren't familiar. It's the river that runs through Shanghai, bisects it. And one side where the Orient Pearl Tower is and all the buildings, the financial district, there's a very famous photo on one side. Looking over there from the, you know, foreign sections, you just see it was fields in like 1990 or 1995 or something. And then you look at it today and it's just unbelievable. Wow.
Well, I was here. I saw that.
You saw it all happen.
Yeah.
You were here for the subways being built.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
seen
yeah,
the whole
yeah.
Thing.
They were, I arrived, Pudong Airport was in construction.
Wow.
So I arrived in Hongqiao and basically Pudong was on a maquette of what was going to be built, right? And so that's why I always say to people until this day, I don't do Pudong. You will never get me to do a meeting in Pudong. It's because for me, Pudong did not exist.
Right.
So I do it once a year and it's at a friend's house barbecue. So yeah. I do it once a year. I go to Pudong.
You just don't cross the river.
I don't cross the river. I'm a snob.
So you have, if in Canada, you'd have this really, I don't want to say unique because there's a vast population of these Quebecois, these French Canadian Ontarians. But even in Canada, your kind of cultural mishmash, your identity would be something that's really unique. What is that? Like, what do you tell people you are when they're, I mean, you've been overseas for about as long as anyone I've spoken to. And by the time this goes out, people will have heard an interview with my friend Rich Robinson, who's been living in, you know, overseas in some fashion for, you know, 25 years, but he is such a strong identity with his Boston roots. Like, he wears it on his sleeve and it comes, it's one of the first things he'll tell you, and you'll hear it in his voice. Now, you have, of course, that lovely French Canadian lilt, which is wonderful, very identifying. But how do you, like, do you think of yourself as Canadian? Do you think of yourself as French Canadian, Quebecois, Ontarian? How does that work?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Actually, what comes out of my mouth, it's always French Canadian. So I always put the word French in front. So I'm French Canadian.
Of course.
But then it gets tricky because people often ask me, oh, so you're from Quebec. And if I'm lazy, I'll say yes. But if I'm not, I'll say, well, it's a bit more complicated. And then I go through my story. But I will definitely say I'm French Canadian.
So how do you go back a lot?
Yeah, well, so I went through in 22 years, I went through times that I didn't come home for 2-3 years. And then I went through time that I was doing a lot of business in Toronto. So I was there maybe 4 times a year. And now I'm back to every 6 weeks, I go back to Montreal.
Whoa.
And I stay for 3 weeks.
Whoa.
Because my son is now back in Montreal.
Oh, how old is your son?
He's 18.
Wow. So did he grow up here in China, I'm assuming?
He was born here. Wow. And he was here until he was 16, 17 years old.
Yeah. I got to talk to him. he's got a French Canadian mom, grew up in China. Now he's back. Is he in Toronto for school?
No, he's in Montreal.
Oh, Montreal for
school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's got to be a trip.
Exactly.
Does he speak French?
Of course. He speaks French, English, and a good comprehension and level of speech in Chinese also.
Wow. That's great. So you've actually gone through the whole life cycle here. You did all the grown-up stuff. You came here as a youngin' right out of school, did the crazy party thing. Then you had the kid, did the family thing, the mom thing, and now you're doing the empty nest thing.
Exactly.
What is the empty nest thing like in China, or just as an overseas person? This is actually a new thing for me.
Yep.
Your kid is gone. What's that all about?
Well, do you know what? I had to get used to it, right? So I was a bit lost. Because you come back home, you don't have that person that you need to cater to or whatsoever. And then all of a sudden you say, okay, well, I can do whatever I want. But what is that, right? So I went through a phase that I went nuts again, going out and, you know, having a lot of fun.
That's one of the things living overseas with an expat community, that there's always opportunity to go out and have fun and do crazy stuff.
Yeah. And then, you know, I had to take a step back and say, okay, so what do I really want to focus on? It's like my second career that is coming up, right? And I've chose traveling. Yeah, really, because this is really where what I love. It's discovering. I've just did a, you know, try to find your purpose in life and everything. And one thing that I love is to know what get people to discovering things, right? So to me, curiosity is a very important thing. So I've decided to wherever I travel to, I'll do some work and I also will explore and to try to see what's out there.
Now you're in the garment business, right?
Yeah.
So you were telling me before you do sourcing and manufacturing?
Yes. So that's my core business. So it's design, sourcing, manufacturing. And I like to say that it's for the Americas because usually the clients are from overseas, but in Canada, the US, Mexico, and Brazil.
I usually don't go through people's careers and their CVs because it's not really, it's just kind of one facet. It's one expression we all have of our identities, right?
Yeah.
But you just said you want to travel a lot. I imagine the way the global economy is so interconnected that affords you, that career affords you the opportunity to travel all over the place. Do you find yourself kind of picking your spots or looking for areas for your business to move or grow in based on where you want to go? Are you using your business as a tool and excuse to travel is what I'm asking?
Yes, yes, definitely I am. And if I can continue to do that, damn, I will do that.
Yeah. Where are the places that are on your mind right now, both for business and to travel because you want to go there?
Well, basically, I explored in 2018 Africa. And I'm super hype about Africa. There's so many things and so many things that I don't know nothing about. So it's really, really interesting. And just for you to know is that I have a startup now, and it's a fashion incubator to help any new business in fashion to accelerate and have a push up to go faster in business. So one thing is that I want to take this on the road. So this is something that I can bring to other countries and just saying, okay, who needs some coaching? Who needs some tips? So there I get to experience different culture, different places, but the common thing is fashion.
Were there people helping you like that? Were there people offering mentorship? You are a woman and you are moving to, you know, expats, especially in China, the majority of them are men. So I can only imagine that in the 90s, you must have been one of a handful of foreign women here doing their own thing. Were there people here helping you? Was the community welcoming? Was the community supportive? How was that?
You know, mentorship, that's one of the reasons I got into it, is that I did not have the help that I'm given right now. Right. So to me, that's a giving back of my knowledge, right? However, community was really welcoming, because at that time, the expat community was very small, right? And then if you go on the flip side, the Chinese community, I was something very special because there was not a lot of us. So I was welcome from both sides. So with that, you get some help that is not really directly to what you need, but there's a kind of support, and you start to build your support system also. Because I remember my first few years, I thought it was a very lonely place because of the language barrier, the culture barriers. So I spent a lot of time with myself, right? And then when you start breaking out of that, you start making friends and you build little community and support system.
So the migration experience for many people is lonely because almost by definition, unless you're moving with your family, you're out on your own and you're going to a place where you're not from. You have no support system. So the overwhelming majority of us are moving to places where we don't know anybody, or we know a couple of acquaintances or maybe a friend or two. You can be in a city of 20 million people and feel really lonely. So how did you, before the age of the internet, you know, at least in China, there was no internet really back then. So how did you kind of cope with that loneliness? What was the scene like? In terms of people, I imagine everyone is reaching out to everyone because no one is an island, right? And you have to have community. So what were some of the things that were happening in the community where you noticed people were reaching out?
Well, so when I came in, I was a fashion design teacher, right? So basically, it was the first international design school. And so we were a group of expats. So basically, we became very close. So that was the support system that we built. So loneliness, it's always when you go back home in the apartment, which was not a service apartment that you see now everywhere in Shanghai. So it used to be very concrete, damp, quite lonely. So you would go back home and you say, okay, so I need to make a life of myself here.
I'm here to sleep and I got to get out again.
Exactly. So, and you know, when I said to you, my home is where my two feet are, I'm the type of person that I need to have my space, and it needs to be Amelie's space, right? So what you do, you start shopping around, looking and talking to people, and you start to build your own comfortable environment. And then you start inviting people to come and see. And you make those link and relationship with people around you. And often it was my translator, because they were translating everything that I was teaching. So then I would invite them home and I would get to know them. It could have been students also. And then as the group would just become bigger, right? And you start making friendship. But loneliness, let me tell you, sometimes 22 years, like today, I can still feel lonely sometimes. So it's not gone 100%. You need to just learn to deal with it.
So I'm very lucky in my journey. I have a partner and, you know, we live together. We do most everything together. And, you know, we don't feel quote, lonely because we have each other, but there are these moments where it's interesting. It's not missing your family. Like it's not, it's missing, but not that you want to be there. It's missing kind of just the feeling that you can go. So I remember I had this, well, this has happened many times over, but I've had friends who have lived in Beijing, become very, very close to, and they'll say they're leaving. And I hate going away parties. I don't even go to them really. I'll have a dinner with someone without a party, but there'll be this kind of moment where you realize, wow, we've only seen each other like twice in this year. But it's not the fact that you didn't see them every week. It was the fact that you know you could. And somewhere in your subconscious, there's this kind of safety net, this emotional safety net, as if you really need someone, they are there. But once they leave the city, they're gone. So it's a kind of a different, like it's the loneliness of a different sort where you don't actually have to have the people around you all the time. You just need to know they're there. And I'm wondering, so you've been in Shanghai for 22 years. How many, have you gone through this cycle? Do you pick and choose your friends? Do you have any people who've been here that long? Do you have a specific friends and how does that work? Because I know in Beijing, for instance, myself and there are other people, we put up this barrier. And if you haven't been here for more than 5 or 6 years, we're not even going to talk to you because, you know, why are we going to emotionally invest? So what is that like for you? Where are you at in that cycle?
Yeah, I've been nodding to whatever you were saying because, yeah, that cycle, I've done it and redid it. And
also, you even did it with your own kid.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's just so, it's a very broad, way of, emotion that comes in while you're asking the question. So the cycle, the problem is that, yeah, it's like always, it's like breakups, right? So you get very close with people and then all of a sudden, they go away. So then you feel sad, you feel a bit lonely. And then it starts again, you meet a new bunch of people coming in and the friendship builds up and you tend to go deep very quickly because we are expats, right? So it's not that, okay, I'll see you once a month. It's basically, we see each other quite often and often it goes through the kids' friends. And, you know, there's a whole lot of different cycle to a point that I kind of shut down and I didn't want new friends. I was like, okay, I'm done. You know, it's like, it's too painful. People are coming and go. And even my son experienced that at one moment of his very young life. He had very, very good friends and all of a sudden they disappeared.
Yeah. One of our previous guests, Tanya Crossman, she's been researching TCKs and she says that they have this common experience amongst themselves, even if they've never met, they've all gone through this same thing where they will have friends who have come into school, they've become really close friends and they're gone in a couple of years. And they, it's just that their whole life is like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I remember, my son expressed himself way better than myself. He looked at me and he goes, "When are we going away? I've been here all of my life." And then I was just like, oh, wow, yeah. So do we want to go away? Are we okay to see those cycle coming in?
Do you want to go away? Are you okay? I'm asking. Are you?
Let's exactly. Answer that question. So, you know, I went through phase 2-3 years ago that it was like, okay, I'm packing my bag. I'm leaving. And then you realize that, well, I realized for myself that it was me personally that was not doing well. It was not that I wanted to leave Shanghai or China. And I came to the conclusion now that no, I don't want to leave. However, I have my 2 feet also in Montreal now. So I've got I call it tiny home in Montreal and a tiny home here in Shanghai. And I really, really like that approach. So no, I'm not ready to leave.
Everyone has to find their own cycle that works. I know that myself and my wife, we are kind of in this stage where we know we're going to be overseas for a while. Mm. We know we're going to be living this migrant lifestyle for maybe 10, 15, maybe 20 years. Who knows? But it's for the foreseeable future. And we are really trying to figure out what does that mean for us? What is that natural cycle? You know, where is, quote, home base? Maybe not home. Home is wherever we're living, where we're together, but what is home base? And is it different? And if so, what does it mean for us? And where is it? You know, is it Sedona, Arizona? Is it Boston? Is it Seattle? Is it someplace we don't know yet? This is kind of something I feel like after you've been overseas for a while, if you're the kind of migrant that is able to travel a lot, or you have the agency to be able to go back and forth, you kind of have to find that rhythm on your own. And it's kind of a new phase of life that we're coming into, which I wouldn't say I'm having trouble navigating it, but it's this new, you never think about it growing up. No one tells you when you're growing up that this could be a thing in your life. They say you find it, you know, you go to college, you get education, you get a career, you get married, you buy a house, you know, that never comes into the, what will your international cycle of travel every year be? So I don't know really who to talk to about this stuff, which is, I guess, kind of the reason why I do the show. So let me ask you, when you had your son, what was your cycle with him? I mean, you had a family. Was there regular travel back to for him to see his grandparents, or how did that work out?
Yeah, exactly. As soon as Tristan was around, basically it was going back home at least once a year for Christmas.
Just to middle of nowhere, Ontario?
Exactly.
Wow.
Really, really, really.
You must have loved that.
And yes, it was so funny because raised and born here in Shanghai, snow, he didn't know until we brought him in the snow. And that kid just would not leave the outside. He wanted to be in the snow every time that he could, which I was like, oh my God, we're traveling to for Christmas again. But no, you want, even though that you're an expat, my roots are Canadian. So definitely my son, I wanted him to understand what Canadian were and are. And you realize that it's
Did he get that? Is he Canadian?
I would say now he's Canadian, but he was a very confused child at one given point in his life.
This is the typical TCK story.
Yeah. And so we enrolled Tristan. I've got two stories if we have time. Yes. It's a good story in the sense that he was born in 2000, and this blue-eyed, blonde-haired kid.
They must have been touching his
hair, yeah.
Taking your picture.
If I could trace all the picture we took, I'm sure they're plastered everywhere, right? It was really at the right beginning. And so I put him, because I was always working, so I put him in daycare, which we called it the baby club.
The one year old.
And he was always the only foreigner with Chinese kids and the IEs and so forth. And for 3 years, he was in those Chinese school. And one day he came up to me and he goes, Mom, and he pulled his hair and he goes, anybody like me? Meaning that any other blonde kids. And then I looked at him. Yeah. And I had to think, and I went and searched, and we had the French Lycée Français right here on Genoa-Lou. So I made an appointment, went and visit. And as soon as we visited the school, the director goes, okay, this classroom would be the type of classroom you would participate in. And they were all sitting in circle.
This is French school.
French school. Tristan ran in, sat in the circle, and waved at us to go home. And that's where I understood at a young, young age, you see that you're very different, even though you didn't know otherwise, right? So my dream of him being this blue eye, golden hair, but speak only Chinese type of kid, like just kind of vanished and say, okay, he needs to get into that expat environment because he was asking for it. So that was one of the part, the first step. And then a bit later on, so when you speak to my son, he has a French accent, French from France, right? So he does not have the Canadian French accent. He has to mimic me if he wants to mimic, right?
So he doesn't speak the real French.
No,
he doesn't speak the Québécois. I love you. Oh, I know all about that.
So one time I went to a parent's visit at the school, and then the teacher goes, oh, I can sense a little French-Canadian accent. So the father must be French. So I looked at the teacher. I said, no, the father is not French. He's from Montreal. And then she goes, well, your son is saying that he is from Lyon. So he was telling everybody that he was coming from Lyon. And so when he came home, I said, Tristan, what are you telling everybody? He goes, oh, it's easier, Mom, to say that. So we had to have that conversation of, no, you're not from France. You are from... He goes, but I've never lived in Canada. So I don't even know what being Canadian is. So he was very confused.
Because you were sending him to French school, yeah. Not Canadian school.
No, that's right. It. Yeah. So all of his class were very different from what he would have learned in Canada, right? So it was also a big learning curve for myself. So how could I be upset with him saying, well, I feel more French than Canadian because I'm going to school with French pupils, right?
So I'm interested that at home you were speaking, then I imagine, French, not Québécois.
Well, I would speak Quebecois. He would answer me in French, but you know what I mean.
Well, but I know. But were you able to understand each other? Because I know I've seen it happen where the French show up in Montreal and the Quebecois really give it to them, and the French are like, "What is he saying?"
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so the thing is that I kind of brushed my French since I'm in China, so I do.
Oh, you kind of have to.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. But then if I get upset, then the good old Quebecois comes out,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Wow, that's so interesting. I've actually never heard it quite like that, with the child kind of realizing that, hey, I'm different and I need to find something that I'm not so different. How old was he when that happened?
So the first time he was 3 years old.
3 years old.
Yeah.
Was it because like kids were pulling his hair, do you think? I mean, was it people pointing at him? And
well, it's a mixture, right? So he was always the teacher's pet. Because they always want to, to touch him and take him in his arm and everything. Oh. So then sometimes he would get bullied.
There's a lot of differences. Yeah, that's so kind of, it's his differences is being highlighted all the time.
Yeah. And the other thing is that he would always get 10 on 10 on everything. As if that, you're always like the perfect child, right?
The cute blondes always get it so easy. So this sounds a lot different than the kind of foreign or international education that I know through my limited experience through my wife and the teachers that she knows and the stuff that I've learned through osmosis through her. Was he in a Chinese school or was it an international school or an international program?
In the first 3 years, he was in Chinese school, and then San and San was the Taiwanese international school.
Oh, okay.
But it was pretty much Asian, right?
Right. It sounds very different than how it would be today.
Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I did it before.
Yeah.
The new parents, I feel so much for them.
Right.
There's so many choice and also competition and getting into schools. And I'm just like, wow.
When you're only able a handful of foreigners, all the schools want him.
exactly. And I said the pressure and everything that is going on. And also, I don't like all the money behind that. So it becomes a business, right? Education in China.
It's big business.
And, I started my career by being a fashion design teacher. And I learned that it was a business, right? So it can be, and there's an ugly side to it. So right now I look at all of the choices and it's hard for parents to make those decisions. So I'm quite happy that I've done that in 2000. Then I'm not doing it now.
So you've done the parenting thing. Mm. Well, I guess you're still doing it. You never stop being a parent. It's kind of like alcoholism. You're always in recovery, right?
Exactly. Well said.
So you've done the raising of the human being to where they are reasonably self-sufficient, can feed themselves and won't fall over and die, So now you said you want to travel a lot. That's kind of your new mission. How long did it take you to kind of find that new balance with yourself? And how successful do you feel you're being at living the life you want?
What I can tell you, it took me 18 months.
18 months?
Yeah.
It's like how long it takes to break up with someone after a really long relationship.
Yeah, yeah. And why I say 18 months, it's because I went through a phase of really trying to understand what's next. And it's really since last September, I said, okay, I've got this. And I started to do the 6 weeks in China, 3 weeks in Canada, and it felt good. And I was getting my projects off the ground. And I realized that it's coming to me. This is where I should be. So I realized that you don't need to be 100% at one place all the time. You just need to be organized.
That almost sounds like a lesson you would learn from being a parent. It can't be everything in all that. You got to kind of budget your time, pick your spots, focus your energy, and you got to weed out what's most important to you. And you can only focus on that because everything else is a drain.
True. And I'll tell you the pivot point. It's quite funny, but I've decided to take one word out of my vocabulary.
What's that?
And that changed my life.
Are you allowed to even say the word to tell me what it is, or is it?
Well, that will be an exception, right?
Okay, thank you.
So I took out the word busy.
Oh, good one.
So when people come to me and say, "So how are you?" and often we say, "Oh, I'm so busy," right? I now say, "Oh, I've been so active." So I changed busy with active, or sometimes I'm occupied, depending. But that really opens the door for people wanting, active, doing what? So it opens up conversation, but it freed myself. Because if I'm not busy, I have time to do whatever I want, right?
Right. That's a really neat mental trick. It's just a simple, it's almost like flipping a switch. You're not busy, you're active, which means you are, in theory, just doing stuff.
Yeah.
And then if you don't want to do the stuff you're doing, you can do other stuff. That's great.
Yeah.
I'm going to start using that.
I want you to do that because I've been saying whenever I say that to people, I said, yeah, do it. You'll see the change. It does not happen overnight there. And it took me a good 6 months to, now I never say the word. So it always active that comes out, but I had to train myself. Yeah.
So what are you active in right now?
That new startup that I'm doing right now, it's really getting the program AM360 on the road. And when I say on the road, it's really to be able to coach startups in fashion design wherever they are in the world, either via webinars or face-to-face time.
So you've been in this garment fashion textile business for quite a while now. Again, I don't like to get too much into people's CV, but you've had the opportunity to watch the industry grow here into the, you know, manufacturer for the world. And in the last decade, it's been slowly filtering out to other places. So that kind of ebb and flow, that natural always migration to where the lower costs and that balance between cost and quality is, to you, what's the biggest challenge of managing that? So what I mean is you have certain standards and you want to have whoever supplying you meet those standards, but you also need to mitigate the cost. And how do you balance that? How do you pick and choose where you're going to move your production to or where you're going to look for the best deal? What are you looking for?
One thing is that I've always done what I say, better garments out of China. Because otherwise you don't need me. You can go directly and buy whatever you need directly from the suppliers here in China. So that already puts me on a different benchmark, right? Then, of course, I had good years, and then all of a sudden it got a bit hard. And I can still say today that my value decreased every year, because I had to do a lot more for the same amount of money. The margin gets narrow and so forth. Often a lot of people would just pick up and move from another country where the wages are lower and whatsoever. I truly do not believe in that. I truly believe there's a space to do work and manufacturing where you would like to be. But you have to choose your clients also. I've learned that. It's not changing suppliers or even country where they produce. Maybe it's changing who you sell to and who you want to work with, because that will determine how you're going to grow your business and not just making those margin and working with people. Because what happens often, everybody forget that it's human being behind those sewing machines. cutting at the table. And I like to work with them. I built my business on quality control, but that means that I was working with the workers in the factories. So I've got this attachment. So wherever I would, let's say, move production, I would want that same contact with the suppliers. I'm pretty much a hands-on person. So this is really important. So what happened is that now I'm in my last transition of that business, which I've decided to be very transparent. And what I do is that I partner with one of my ex-employee. She opened up a factory and we partner up in this way. And so now I offer product that is directly to the factory, which I'm involved with. So you have really a transparent line of cost, and people can negotiate directly with the supplier.
It's a whole new model.
Yeah.
So this has been my, like I said, I don't ever go into people's jobs, at least not in great detail like that. But this has been my way to trick you into start thinking, because I want to ask my next question is, what's next? And I don't just mean professionally. I mean, you've had this whole life blazing this trail, figuring out how all this works, learning about the balance between quality and location, price and all that stuff. And you've raised a kid, you've sent him off to college, you've figured out this cycle, your new thing to travel, your new way to do this incubator for global textile people, garment manufacturers. So where is it all going?
Next step is, I think I'm at the point that I just want to give back. 22 years in China, it's like you can multiply that by three. You know, 1 year is 3 years, right? That's what we say.
I call it China time.
Yeah, China time. Yeah, perfect. That's perfect. Yeah. So I'm at the point that now I want to choose. So I'm living. I don't work. I live, right? So I'm living. So I want to give back. So I want to be part of communities. I want to be able to give a hand. But I'm not Mother Teresa also. I need to...
No, you got
to
eat.
That's it. I need to eat, right? So my next step is that I'm not too sure where things will bring, but it's basically to be able... what we're doing right now, to tell my story. I'm writing a book on my life right now. It's an exercise for myself, but I just want to be able to give to my son, okay, so this is basically who I am. As much as I can share experience that I've went through, it might help people, right, around me. So often instead of saying, okay, well, I need to help the hunger in the world or whatsoever, well, look around you and see who you can help there and see where that brings you, right? So it's a bit that the giving back. Because I think I was lucky enough to acquire so much experience, and it's really living experience. And so if I can say my story and give some tips and a hand to people that needs it, why not, right?
So where, and I'm pushing this out a little bit further because this is something that doesn't come up in conversation a lot, especially with migrants, expats. Mm-hmm. What's kind of the end goal? You know, when we're in our home cultures, there's the vision of, you can call it retirement, but, you know, there's some stage where you quote, settle down or you stop running or whatever however you want to phrase it. So what does that look like for you? What do you imagine? Like, we don't have a structure, a model. We kind of figure it out on our own. Or maybe we go back to where we came from and we use that model. What's your model?
Yeah, that's a good question. I need to figure that one out. But I've been saying for a few years now that the vision that I have is that I have a spice garden somewhere. And it's basically a bread and breakfast that people comes in and just come and experience Emily's Spice Garden.
I have to say, this is pretty common.
Like, so that's the vision, because that's where you want to just, you know?
You know, it's funny. I've just started having these conversations, and I rarely speak with people who are, to use the word, old enough to at least be cognizant that that is something that they need to think about. You know what I mean? And the people that I've spoken to, a lot of them have this vision that involves somehow anchoring or being a part of a community where there's a lot of transition, like that B&B thing, like there's people coming and going. Mm. And it's very much the life that we live.
Yeah.
People coming and going.
You know? Exactly.
It's really interesting, and I'm really kind of excited to. I want to speak to more people who have been overseas for a good quarter of a century, like Lena, like yourself, and talk about that. Like, what does it mean to be on the other side of a career, starting another one? You know, and what does that mean? Having raised your family, what comes next? Like, when people think about expats and migrants, they think of young people, not incorrectly. We're mostly statistically speaking young on the younger side. So that kind of leaves out, well, what happens as we grow older? What do we do? And I don't know that there's a lot of people thinking about that, and we need to think about it.
Yeah, we need to think about it. But I think it's also being able to have a mindset about it, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we follow the norm of where we were brought up or born in, it's basically, well, you go back home, you buy yourself your little condo, and then, you know, to me, it would be my death. If you're asking me that, that's what you're going to do when you reach 65 years old. So it's that mindset that needs to be given, and what is out there for us, right? The only thing that really scares me in our, breed of migrants?
Demographic.
Yeah, exactly.
Cohort.
Is that we need to have our health.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing that I could tell you where I have fear. And, you know, health is, without health, then we do encounter bigger problems, right? So if I can figure that one out, then I'll be a step closer to answering you the next time we talk.
Well, it's been really exciting to meet you. Finally, we've encountered each other online once or twice, and we have mutual acquaintances. And I've really enjoyed learning your story, and I look forward to getting to know you more. I hope we have more interactions. I want to thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Well, there you have it. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. And thanks to Amelie for taking the time to have a conversation. I really enjoyed it. Don't forget to leave any feedback if you've got any questions about this topic or suggestions for other topics we could cover, any areas of interest that you want to explore about the expat experience or the migration life. If you have any guest suggestions, interview suggestions, please reach out. You can reach me at mike.shaw@migrationmedia.net, and I'm on Twitter at ZAX2000. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.